What the hell is going on here?
I'm very impressed, Alice. How's Jerry this morning?
I think the more important question is, who are you?
Those are much bigger questions than you think. Please sit down. For reasons that will soon be regrettably clear, I'm going to tell you a secret. Then you can judge what and who I am. Years ago, I worked for the Central Intelligence Agency on the MK-Ultra program. Are you familiar with it?
It was mind control, Manchurian candidate kind of stuff.
That's a vulgar generalization, but yes, you take an ordinary man and turn him into an assassin. That was our goal. Now, MK-Ultra was terminated in 1973, but not the research that I continued. Shall I go on?
The truth will set you free.
It involved hallucinogenic research, electroshock to induce vegetative states, terminal experiments in sensory deprivation.
Terminal.
And resulting in death. Alice, I'm now trying to pay my penance.
These things that you're talking about, you did them to Jerry.
MK-Ultra was science, sanctioned by the government. But of course, it all ended the moment that John Hinckley shot Ronald Reagan. Hey, no, that wasn't us.
Holy Acid Wars. In 1951, a former naval officer described a secret of certain military intelligence organizations. He called it pain drug hypnosis. And he said, "It's a vicious war weapon and may be of considerably more use in conquering society than the atomic bomb. This is no exaggeration. The extensiveness of the use of this form of hypnotism in espionage work is now so widespread that it has long passed the time when people should have become alarmed about it. Pain drug hypnosis is a wicked extension of narcosynthesis, the drug hypnosis used in America only during and since the last war." That naval officer was none other than L. Ron Hubbard. Before the war, an explorer and prolific science fiction writer, he went on to found one of America's fastest-growing, if controversial, religions, Scientology. In an exchange of letters, Hubbard told me that which he had written a book called Excalibur, which had been stolen. The information in the book, he said, had been subsequently published in as many other books. Excalibur was, he intimated, the guts of what he would publish as Dianetics, a work which takes all the mind control insights of Hubbard, which exposed both in his travels in the East and in naval intelligence, and applies them in an attempt to empower the human spirit, the exact opposite of mind control as it came to be practiced by the cryptocracy. He was subsequently kidnapped and his office was ransacked, allegedly by men looking for drafts of the original manuscript. Later, the Church of Scientology was hounded by the government for years, much as others like Wilhelm Reich had been hounded, for spreading the truth about technologies which may have had the potential to liberate rather than enslave. Several years after Hubbard's death, the Internal Revenue Service granted the Church of Scientology in 1993 official recognition. It finally granted them the tax-deductible status which run-of-the-mill religious groups have been trouble obtaining. In the late 1990s, there has been expressed growing suspicion that the Church of Scientology became co-opted by the cryptocracy after Hubbard's death. Other information suggests that Hubbard had been part of the cryptocracy from the very beginning. And so the Church of Scientology was another one of the cryptocracy's cults from the beginning. Our direct and specific questions in 1994 to high-ranking Scientologists have been ignored. Hubbard's statement on pain drug hypnosis was the tip of the iceberg of mind control research using drugs as an aid to hypnotic induction. In the 1950s, under Air Force and ultimately CIA guidance, a series of papers were written defining the limits to which a government, ours or an enemy, could go to make persons behave against their will. In an introduction to one of these, the authors stated that the purpose of the study was to review available scientific knowledge on the use of pharmacological agents to influence communication of information which, for one reason or another, an informant does not wish to reveal. This is otherwise known as the third degree. They went on to say that, contrary to alleged necessity for conducting such drug experiments, no published reports have come to attention detailing the scientific application of drugs by intelligence agencies of any nation as a means of obtaining information. The methods of Russian interrogation and indoctrination are derived from the age-old police methods that have been systemized and are not dependent on drugs, hypnotism, or any other special procedure designed by scientists. The report expressing concern over proper drug experimentation and urged that controlled placebos be administered silently so that no one would know who was getting what or when. Also discussed were the effects of drugs on different individuals in various settings, the relation between dosage levels, the effect of food and drink, and other physiological needs, and the effects of individual variables such as sex, intelligence, medical and psychiatric status, life situation, and so forth upon drug reactions. The top priority for testing and mind control were those drugs which were found to induce hypnosis. The administration and effects of barbiturates, amitriptyline, sacubitril, pentanol, and sodium amytal were studied. Non-barbiturate sedatives and calmatives such as ethylchloroethyl, glutamathione, methprenine, methprophenol, captopril, and exenamide were also tested. A whole range of amphetamines and their derivatives were discussed as good tools to produce a rush, an outpouring of ideas, emotions, and memories, and so forth. New drugs such as Ritalin, Marsalid, and Mescaline were thought to hold great promise for mind control applications. Perhaps the most promising of the last group was called consciousness expanding, a drug called lysergic acid dimethyltide, LSD-25. 4 months after the nuclear reaction was created in a pile of uranium ore in Chicago, the psychotropic effects of LSD-25 were discovered by a 37-year-old Swiss chemist working at the Sandoz Research Laboratory in Basel, Switzerland. On April 16, 1943, Dr. Albert Hoffman accidentally absorbed a minute quantity of rye fungus byproduct with which he was experimenting with. He later filed a report which described history's first LSD trip. I was forced to stop my work in the laboratory in the middle of the afternoon and go home, as I was seized by a particular restlessness associated with a sensation of mild dizziness, kind of drunkenness, which was not unpleasant and which was characterized by extreme activity of imagination. There surged upon me an uninterrupted stream of fantastic images of extraordinary plasticity and vividness, and accompanied by an intense kaleidoscope like play of colors. Sandoz Laboratories had actually been manufacturing LSD since 1938, when it was first used in an experiment with monkeys. Their scientists observed that when the substance caused a marked excitation of the animals, the results did not motivate scientists to follow up with their research. Work with LSD fell into abeyance until the spring of 1943, when Hoffman propelled a new batch for the storeroom and accidentally ingested some himself. Dr. Hoffman described the LSD experience. "I did not know what was going to happen. If I'd ever come back, I thought I was dying or going crazy. My first experiment with LSD was a bum trip, as people would say nowadays." Dr. Hoffman's new discovery was investigated by the European psychiatrist as a possible key to the chemical nature of mental illness. In 1950, LSD was introduced to American psychiatrists, and interest spread rapidly in the scientific community there. In 1953, the CIA made plans to purchase 10 kilograms of LSD for use in drug experiments with animals and human beings. Since there are more than 10,000 doses in a gram, that meant that the CIA wanted 100 million doses. The CIA obviously intended to corner their market on LSD so that other countries would not be ahead of the U.S. in their potential for LSD warfare. Later, the cryptocrats were to say that they'd merely gotten milligrams and micrograms confused. That year, Sandoz Laboratories filled many orders for LSD from the CIA and the Department of Defense. According to Hoffman, they continued to do so up until the mid-60s. The Army would visit the labs every 2 years or so to see if any technological progress had been made towards the manufacturing of LSD in large quantities. Dr. Hoffman said that they had never been told the reason for the Army's interest in the drug, but he assumed, from the large quantities being discussed, that it was to be used for weapons research. As an employee of the pharmaceutical house, Dr. Hoffman was in no position to warn the Army's researchers away from the drug, despite his belief that it would be extremely dangerous if used improperly, despite his personal distaste for their work. "I had perfected LSD for medical use, not as a weapon. It can make you insane or even kill you if it's not properly used under medical supervision. In any case, the research should have been done by medical people and not by soldiers or intelligence agencies." In 1963, Hoffman received a letter from the scholar at Harvard requesting 25 kilograms of psilocybin for research purposes. Psilocybin is a psychedelic substance similar in effect to LSD, but subtler and much less powerful. Before the sales department at Sandoz would act on this order for the extraordinarily large quantity of psychedelic compounds, they asked the scholar to provide them with the necessary import license from the U.S. health authorities. He failed to provide it. Later, Hoffman commented on the unrealistic manner with which he handled this transaction, which left the impression of a person unconcerned with the regulations of society. The scholar's name was Timothy Leary. Leary came to the CIA's attention through a drinking buddy at Berkeley named Frank Barron. Barron had guided Leary through the creation of his first book, a supposed landmark in 1956 psychology circles entitled Interpersonal Diagnosis of Personality. Barron introduced Leary to CIA officials and set him up for his role in the psychedelic 60s. Shortly after Leary entered their circle of cryptocracy, his wife died, and he was left with two children to raise. Miraculously, he offered a well-paying job on the faculty of Harvard University. His boss was a former OSS official, David McClelland, the editor of the Secret Service's important work, Assessment of Men, a book that outlined the framework by which individuals were selected for espionage work during World War II. At Cambridge, Leary launched himself into his work that he was funded by Harvard, which in turn was funded by the National Institute of Mental Health, which in turn was funded secretly by CIA's MKUltra program. Leary began experimenting with LSD on prisoners in the Concord Correctional Facility in Concord, Massachusetts. On the books, this research was funded by the Urris Brothers Foundation in New York City under the auspices of Harvard. What literally Leary learned from the Concord prisoners was published in 1962 in his paper entitled How to Change Behavior. In it, Leary explained what a powerful tool LSD was for changing ways of thinking and living. By 1960, Leary had become fascinated by the effects of LSD upon creativity, so he went to Greenwich Village in New York City. There he began to recruit artists as LSD guinea pigs. He claims to have guided trips for about 3,000 volunteers, among them Allen Ginsberg, Charles Olson, Jack Kerouac, Robert Lowell, Charles Mingus, Miles Davis, John Lennon, Jim Morrison, Aldous Huxley, Arthur Koestler, and Alan Watts, as well as Swamis, gurus, mystics, psychics by the troop. It was poet Allen Ginsberg who, after experiencing the mystical effects on LSD himself, persuaded the uptight Dr. Leary to try it. That marks the time when a very different Leary began to emerge. While Leary had received NMIH grants at the University of California, Berkeley from 1953 to 1956, and while working for the U.S. Public Health Service from 1954 to 1958, at first he denied that any of his psychedelic research projects at Harvard were funded by the government. Yet, in 1979, when I finally sat with him face to face after Operation Mind Control had been published, and naively asked him if he was writing or unwitting in his collaboration with the CIA, Leary answered with, "Who would you work for, the Yankees or the Dodgers? I mean, who was I supposed to work for, the KGB? Previous to my interview with Leary, I had queried National Institute of Mental Health Director Bertram Brown. Brown said that although such research at Harvard University was funded by the Health Education and Welfare and the NIMH grants from the period of 1956 to 1963 records, available for projects supported during that period generally do not go below the major institutional level. Awards are identified as being made to Harvard University, but not to departments or centers within that institution. Here we encounter another example of the government's built-in deniability." Harvard claimed that its records on Leary research could not be located. Leary told ABC Newshack Paul Altemeyer, "The CIA funded and supported and encouraged hundreds of young psychiatrists to experiment with this drug, LSD. The fallout from that was that young psychologists like himself began taking themselves and discovering it was an intelligence-enhancing, consciousness-raising experience." I give the CIA total credit for sponsoring and initiating the entire consciousness movement, countercultural events in the 1960s. On October 6, 1977, Leary told me, "I would say that 80% of my movements, 80% of my decisions I made were suggested to me by CIA people. I like the CIA. The game they're playing is better than Dresden Bureau. They're better than the FBI. They're better than Saigon. They're better than Franco's police. They're better than the Israeli police. There's many times better than the KGB. So it comes down to who are you going to bet on, the Yankees or the Dodgers? I want us to be smartest, okay? I want to help the CIA get us smarter. I knew I was being used by the intelligence agencies of this country. The CIA recognized, when you probably haven't recognized yet, that I'm a very important national asset. I saw in 1962, after Hiroshima, there would never be a big world war. World war would be at the neurological level, not at the level of tanks. I proceeded as an intelligence agent since 1962. I understand that the next war for the control of this planet and beyond had to do with the control of consciousness. So I had to think very carefully about that. I wanted my side to win that war." I asked Leary, who made out the checks for intelligence work. He couldn't tell me. He said, "I'll answer no questions about business. I was recruited by Huxley, Ron Hubbard, who was very important. Sidney Cohen, you understand, I had only segments. Only knew what I had to know." Then Leary tried to interview me. "I want to know who killed Walter Pinckney. I want to know the name of every CIA psychologist who was paid by the CIA. If you give me that list, I will finger that work everyone that then did in relation to CIA and LSD. I want to know the name of every CIA agent, every psychologist that ever worked in telepathy, ESP, magic, the level of Uri Geller and Andre Buharich. I want to know about Werner Earnhardt. Wicked guys, devilish guys, neutral guys, patriotic guys, ITT, that sort of thing. They're also some of the smartest people in the world that really want freedom for as many people as possible in that world that's freaking. So my team is that team. The research on CIA-paid psychologists is still ongoing. I was told by a preeminent psychiatrist that he was undertaking a thorough research effort on this question and will soon be publishing it as a book. The CIA's former chief psychologist, John Gittinger, was asked by Altmaier if the CIA did indeed provide Leary with the LSD which fueled the psychedelic 60s. Gittinger replied on camera. The countercase that I would make in relationship to that is, remember the people who were doing the research were people that would be doing the research regardless of who was the sponsor. That it was not the CIA who asked these people to work on these. These people were working on it, and the CIA helped them do it, particularly. In the spring of 1962, Leary was approached by Mary Meyer, wife of CIA executive Cord Meyer. Leary says he looked up from his desk to see a good-looking woman leaning against the doorpost with her hip tilted provocatively, studying him with a bold stare. She appeared to be in her late 60s, he said. Flamboyant eyebrows, piercing blue-green eyes, the bona fide, beautiful face, amused, arrogant, aristocratic. Dr. Leary, she said coolly, I've got to talk to you. She introduced herself to Leary as Mary Pinchot and told him, I've come from Washington to discuss something very important. I want to discuss how to run an LSD session. I have a friend who's a very important man. He's impressed by what I've told him about my own LSD experiences, and I want other people to have told him. He wants to try it himself, so I'm here to learn how to do it. I mean, I don't want to goof up or something. Leary invited her to bring her friend to Massachusetts for a couple of days, and he'd run a session with them. But Barry refused the idea, saying her friend was such a well-known public figure that that would be impossible. People involved in power usually don't make the best subjects, Leary told her. Don't you think that as a powerful person were in turn on with his wife or girlfriend, it would be good for the world? Mary asked. Nothing that involves brain change is certain, Leary said. But in general, we believe that for anyone who is reasonably healthy and happy, the intelligent thing to do is take advantage of the multiple realities available to the human brain. Later, while Leary and Mary were sharing a glass of wine, according to Leary, Mary said, you poor innocent thing, you have no idea what you've gotten yourself into. You really don't understand what's going on and what's happening in Washington with drugs, do you? Leary admitted he said he'd heard rumors about the military. It's time you learn more, Mary said. The guys who run things, I mean the guys who really run things in Washington, are very interested in psychology, drugs in particular. These people play hardball, Timothy. They want to use drugs for warfare, for espionage, and for brainwashing, and for control. Yes, Leary writes in 1983, describing what he knew in 1962 or before. We've heard about that. Teach us how to run sessions. Use drugs to do good, Mary said. Leary said he felt uneasy, like that heat you get from people who live in a hard political world. There was something calculating about Mary. Still, apparently Leary did turn her on her, and a couple days later put her on a plane back to Washington. 6 months passed before he saw her again. With no warning, she called him to a clandestine meeting in room 171 at the Ritz Hotel in Boston. Everything is going beautifully, Leary reports, she said. On all fronts, in fact. I can't give details, of course, but top people in Washington are turning on. You'd be amazed at the sophisticated of some of the leaders and their wives. We're getting a little group together. People are interested in learning how to turn on. Leary repeated his doubts about getting high with power-oriented people, but Mary protested, saying that there were a lot of very smart people in Washington in those days, but agreeing that power was important to them. And these drugs do give a certain power. That's what it's all about, freeing the mind. Leary reports Mary saying, "Until very recently, control of American consciousness was a simple matter for the guys in charge. The schools instilled docility. The radio and TV networks poured out conformity." According to Leary, Mary told him that drugs were the most vital interest to the power elite in Washington. She said that a few years before she obviously talking about her husband's employers, had become absolutely obsessed with the notion that the Soviets and the Chinese were persuading our POWs in Korea to defect by brainwashing them with LSD and mescaline. "That's certainly possible," Leary quotes Leary saying. "With what we've discovered about set and setting, we know that almost anyone's mind can be changed in any direction." "Any direction?" he says, Mary asked. And Leary replied, "With a minimum of information about the subject's personal life and 2 or 3 LSD sessions, you could get the most conventional person to do outrageous things. Suppose the person wanted to be brainwashed into a certain direction, wanted to change himself," Mary asked. "Easier yet," Leary quotes himself saying. Leary says he struggled with the word utopiites. Mary was delighted. "I told you the first time we went, I want to learn how to brainwash." After talking with Leary about making it a better world, she again asked Leary to teach her how to brainwash. He said that he didn't sound very ladylike, and she burst into laughter, saying, "If I can't teach the use of utopiites to the wives of mistresses of important people in our government, then we can, well, shit, Timothy, don't you see what we can do?" "What?" Leary says, he said. "We can do on a bigger scale what you are absolutely doing with your students. Use these drugs to free people, for peace, not war. We can turn on the cabinet, turn on the Senate, the Supreme Court. Do I have to explain it further?" One wonders who, besides Abby Hoffman, would have the courage to say something like that in public. The cryptocracy took Hoffman seriously when he threatened to dose New York City's water supply. Leary says his response was to feel scared. But, come to think of it, it was close to what the Harvinites in our session rooms, lazily architecturing hopeful futures, had spelled out as a goal of psychedelic research. So Leary told her, "What do you want from me? The drugs? Just a little bit to get started. With our connections, we'll be able to make all the supplies we want. And all you need to do, mainly, I want advice about how to handle sessions and how to handle any problems that come up," Leary reports Mary saying. Leary describes giving her a cram course on psychedelic sessions. Then he drove her to the airport to catch the plane back to D.C. Tim Leary and Richard Alpert were fired from Harvard in 1963. Ostensibly for giving LSD to an undergraduate, but basically because they were giving it indiscriminately to just about anyone who asked, and the news got out. A controversy over the nature of their research exploded into headlines. So Leary and company retreated to Mexico, where they attempted to carry on LSD experiments outside the purview of the press or do-gooders and local government. In June of 1963, they ran afoul of even the notoriously corrupt Mexican government and were expelled from that country for engaging in activities not permitted to a tourist. From Mexico, they moved to a huge estate outside of Millbrook, New York, which was owned by Margaret Mellon Hitchcock and her sons, Tommy and Billy. It may have been mere coincidence that the father of Tommy and Billy, Tommy Hitchcock Sr., an Air Force ace of World War I, who lost his life in 1943 over England, was connected to the highest levels of U.S. intelligence. And there are more and more suspicious circumstances which might be explored at another time, which could indicate that the Hitchcocks were very tight with elements of the cryptocracy. With Hitchcock's support, Leary, Metzner, and Alpert and company established the International Federation for Internal Freedom, later to be called the Castellian Foundation. These organizations served as a platform literally to propagandize for LSD, which he now claimed could save the world from nuclear perdition by blowing the mind. In late November 1963, just after Larry had returned from Mexico, a phone call came from Mary. With urgency in her voice, she insisted on seeing him. "Oh, you reckless Irishman," she said. "You got yourself into trouble again. It's magnificent, these headlong cavalry charges of yours." "What did I do wrong?" Larry said. "Publicity. I told you they'd let you do anything you want as long as you kept it quiet. The plan is to set up psychedelic training centers around the country. Was ingenuous from all sides. They would have felt infiltrated every chapter to get some of their people trained. But they're not going to let CBS film you drugging people on a lovely Mexican beach. You could destroy both capitalism and socialism in 1 month with that sort of thing." "Leary says," Mary said. Leary says he was struck by the brittleness Mary had picked up from, and here Leary knows of what he speaks, turning admirable phrases in the process. "Those stern-eyed, business-suited wasps who shuttle from home to office in limousines, the information brokers, editors, board members, executive branch officials, youngish men with oldish eyes used to see around Harvard Square and the Yale Quad, initiated early in the Calvinist conspiracy, sworn the forever reliable, working for Wild Bill Donovan in Zurich, for Alan Dulles in Washington, for Henry Luce as bureau chiefs, and then shuffling from Newsweek to the Post, manipulators of secret documents, facts, rumors, estimates, arms, inventories, stock margins, voting blocks, industrial secrets, gossip about the sexual and drug preferences of every member of Congress trained to grab and maintain what they can, all loyal to the Protestant belief that the planet Earth sucks." Mary was scared. She burst into tears. "You must be very careful now. Don't make any waves. No publicity. I'm afraid for you. I'm afraid for all of us." Larry tried to calm her, inviting her back to the big house on the estate in Millbrook. "I know what you're thinking, but this is not paranoia. I've gotten mixed up in some dangerous matters. It's real. You've got to believe me," Larry says. She glared at him. "Do you?" The next call for Mary came the day after the assassination of Jack Kennedy. "I'd really been expecting it," Larry says. He could hardly understand her. He said he thought she was either drugged or stunned with grief. Larry says Mary Meyer said they couldn't control him. They couldn't control JFK anymore. He was changing too fast. He was learning too much. "They'll cover everything up. I gotta come see you. I'm scared. I'm afraid. Be careful." That was the last time Larry heard from Mary. He kept waiting for her to call again, but she never did. He didn't know what happened to her until he saw the article in the New York Times. Woman painter shot and killed on canal towpath in Capitol. Mrs. Mary Meyer was a friend of Mrs. Kennedy. Suspect is arraigned. Mary had been shot twice in the left temple and once in the chest at 12:45 in the afternoon of October 13, 1964. Dressed in a sweatsuit, she had been walking along the old Chesapeake and Ohio Canal towpath in Georgetown. Her friend told reporters that she sometimes walked there with her close friend Jacqueline Kennedy. Mary's brother-in-law was the Washington bureau chief of Newsweek, Benjamin Bradley. It was he who identified her body. The article described Bradley as having been an ultimate intimate of the late President Kennedy. The Times article also mentioned Mary's former husband, Cord Meyer Jr., identifying him as a former leader of the American Veterans Committee and the World Federalists. Now a government employee, the CIA, of course, was not mentioned. Police said that the motive was apparently robbery or assault. Her purse was found in her home. The suspect, a black male, was held without bail. Distraught over the news of Mary's death, Leary asked his well-connected friend, Van Wolf, to see what he could find out. Wolf had been a movie mogul, Mike Todd's partner in business, and his attractive young wife was a Rothschild. Over the years, Wolf had developed an incredible network of friends in high places. Leary reports Wolf saying, "Police intelligence knew all about that Mary Meyer case. Apparently, a lot of people are convinced it was assassination. Two slugs in the brain and one in the body? That's not the MO of a rapist. And a mugger isn't going to shoot a woman with no purse in her hand." Leary says that he didn't find out what happened until he read an article in the San Francisco Chronicle sometime later. Leary paraphrases it. "James Truett, the source of the sensational story, was identified as a formal assistant of Philip Graham, publisher of the Washington Post. In interviews with the National Enquirer, Associated Press, and the Washington Post, Truett revealed that a woman named Mary Meyer had conducted a two-year love affair with President John Kennedy and had smoked marijuana with him in the White House. A confidant of Mary Meyer, Truett told a Post correspondent she and Kennedy met about 30 times between January 1962 and 1969. When Kennedy was mentioned, Mary Meyer told Truett that JFK had remarked, "This isn't like cocaine, I'll get you some of that." Truett claimed that Mary Meyer kept a diary of her affair with the president, which was found after her death by her sister Toni Bradley and turned over to James Angleton, chief of the CIA counterintelligence, who took the diary to CIA headquarters and destroyed it. According to the Post, another source confirmed that Mary Meyer's diary was destroyed. This source said the diary contained a few hundred words of vague references to an unnamed friend. Mary Meyer's sister was quoted by the Associated Press as saying, "I knew something about it when Mary was alive." The article, Leary says, also revealed that the former husband of Mary Meyer was Cord Meyer Jr., one of the most influential officials in the CIA, the only agent who had been awarded the Distinguished Intelligence Medal three times. Leary frequently smoked marijuana and took LSD himself. His speeches, which were and still are addressed to overflow audience, were tailor-made for true believers in the new drug cult. Leary issued many public statements on the benefits of LSD to the individual and society. Always pretended to be politically naive, he predicted there would become a day when a new profession of psychedelic guides will inevitably develop to supervise these experiences. Finally, in the mid-60s, Leary coined his famous slogan, "Turn on, tune in, drop out," and spoke at college lectures to the legions of young people who had legally experimented with LSD and other psychedelic substances. Through magazine interviews, television appearances, movies, records, and books, Leary projected himself as the culture hero of a new generation, which was fighting for an individual right to alter his own consciousness, a right Leary then maintained, which was guaranteed by the Constitution of the United States. A declassified CIA memo dated November 1, 1963, features Dr. Leary and Dr. Richard Alpert, and the organization which advocated the expansion of consciousness through psychedelic chemicals, International Federation for Internal Freedom. In alarming notes and tones, the memo ordered all CIA groups involved in mind control operations to report if any agency personnel were involved with either Leary or Alpert or the IFF. The responses to this in-house memo have not been released by the CIA. By 1968, society seemed to be divided into those who had taken psychedelic drugs and those who hadn't. Eventually, LSD, marijuana, and cocaine were available on street corners and schoolyards throughout the land. The cryptocracy had covertly supported Leary and Associates, and the snowballing effects of their LSD propaganda now caused an apparent reversal of the policy. Was it that LSD and other dangerous psychoactive drugs were politically dangerous and that they suspended the conditioning of people, if only temporarily, long enough to see the lies they were being fed? Was it that they suspended the conditioning long enough for people to see through the indoctrination of the government, span the credibility gap, and the government propaganda for the Vietnam War? The acid heads began to act with visionary fervor. They started to actively criticize the war in Vietnam and call for many social reforms. The psychedelic revolution embarrassed the government at every turn. But If the government didn't deliberately create the psychedelic revolution, it certainly was responsible for shutting it down. It did this by controlling the availability, and this by controlling the availability and quality of drugs. The very underground LSD labs which the CIA had helped set up were raided. Then it wasn't long before the quality of LSD degenerated and the supply dried up. Several studies have shown that when LSD became illegal on October 6, 1966, pure LSD became scarce and the habits of the drug culture changed. Domestic counterintelligence agencies began to manipulate the press, trying to overcome all the favorable publicity psychedelics had received. A Science article ran in 1967, which claimed that LSD caused damage to the chromosome, proved to be untrue. The article, which picked up and carried by the Journal of American Medical Association, which warned of LSD-induced malformations, fetal loss, and mental retardation. This article was widely quoted, even in subculture press. In 1971, Science ran a survey of all available literature and concluded that LSD did not cause genetic damage. In 1969, Diane Linkletter jumped from a window to her death. Her father, talk show host Art Linkletter, blamed her death on the effects of LSD. "It was murder," he said. "She was murdered by the people who manufacture and sell LSD. LSD can kill." Linkletter got a letter, a lot of press and private audience with President Nixon. In 1982, Linkletter told author Jenny Alderson that there was never any proof that LSD was involved with his daughter's death. Rumors in the underground press had it that LSD caused flashbacks. Psychedelic sojourners of the 60s are still waiting for those flashbacks to happen. The Journal of Psychoactive Drugs did a survey which showed no more flashbacks from those that had taken LSD than from those who practiced yoga or other forms of meditation. But, simultaneous with the negative press about LSD, the supply began to dry up and large supplies of heroin mysteriously became available. It was strong heroin imported from the Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia, largely under CIA control. Many people who had their consciousness expanded too far to distinguish between one drug and another turned to heroin. The government-inspired hysteria over drugs led many to think, well, they lied to us about pot, they must be lying to us about heroin. And so, when psychedelics were no longer easily obtained, and heroin was, many young people became addicts. The political visions of the psychedelic generation faded as many who had turned on dropped out of city life and fled the country. Those who stayed in the cities followed Leary's advice and dropped out from participation in the mainstream of the society. Many of them followed an alternative route in the American tradition by living as pushers and bootleggers, making large sums of money from the newly created demand for illegal drugs. In 1958, Dr. Louis Gottschalk, the CIA's independent contractor, had prepared a think tank report which suggested that the intelligence agencies might control people through addiction. Pressing the cunning behind the unwitting war on drugs, Gottschalk's report put it in this way. The addiction of a source to a drug which the interrogator could supply obviously would foster the dependence of the source on the interrogator. Where the source was addicted previous to the situation, the interrogator might find, already established, a pattern of invasion of laws and responsibilities which the addict had developed to meet his need for the drug and society which prescribes its use. The report went so far as to recommend that wounded GIs who had become addicted to pain-killing drugs be recruited for hospitals. It stated, where the source had become addicted in the setting as is equal to the treatment of injuries, the ability of the interrogator to give or withhold the drug would give a powerful weapon against the source. In the late 1960s, when it became known that thousands of GIs serving in Vietnam had become addicted to Laotian heroin, the U.S. Bureau of Narcotics tried sending a team of agents to Laos, but its investigations were blocked by the Laotian government, the State Department, and the CIA. While the Laotian government hostility toward the Bureau is understandable, the reticence shown by the American government and the CIA requires some explanation. According to U.S. narcotics agents serving in Southeast Asia, The Bureau encountered a good deal of resistance from the CIA and the embassy when it first decided to open an office in Vietnam. Did this policy bear some relation to Gottschalk's think tank statement made some 30 years earlier to create an army to drug-dependent people who could be controlled by their suppliers, and in this case, the CIA? The CIA also contributed indirectly to the heroin traffic by training men in smuggling operations, men who then turned to smuggling drugs. In the 1974 Pulitzer Prize-winning study of the heroin trade by the staff and editors of Newsday, it was revealed the U.S. Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs agents in Miami cross-checked a list of men who landed at the Bay of Pigs against police records. They found that at least 8% of the 1,500 men CIA-trained force had subsequently been investigated or arrested for drug dealing. If it hadn't been for the CIA training, one Bureau of Narcotics Dangerous Drugs agent was quoted as saying, some of these might never have gone into the smuggling business at all. He added that their training in paramilitary operations, weapons use, and smuggling of equipment and men from one place to another is well suited for illegal drug importing. The head of the Office of Strategic Intelligence, John Warner, said, "The key to heroin trafficking is the principle of compartmentality. It's the same way the CIA operates. Most people don't know what the whole project involves. Most just know the particular job." Former CIA agent Victor Marchetti was reported as saying, "The CIA is implicated in the drug traffic in several countries. The mafia, thanks to the CIA, has a free hand in the vast opium traffic from Turkey through Italy to the United States." On July 19, 1975, Senator Charles Percy released a letter charging that the CIA had the Justice Department drop a drug case to protect its own involvement in drugs. Percy's letter said that the CIA refused to give federal prosecutors evidence in a case against Pudenberg Kramer, a CIA employee, and one of their other persons. Percy complained that apparently CIA agents are untouchable, however serious their crime or however harm is done in society. The senator's letter said he had written the Justice Department to find out why charges were dropped against the two men, who were allegedly attempting to smuggle 59 pounds of opium into the United States from Thailand. The reply he received from Deputy Assistant Attorney General John C. Kenney stated that CIA Assets Associate General Counsel John Greeney had insisted that there were other considerations at stake and that there were materials sought by the prosecutors would not be turned over, Kenney said. Greeney had explained that if Kerkorian and his associate went on trial, the situation could prove embarrassing because of Mr. Kumar's involvement with CIA activities in Thailand, Burma, and elsewhere. The CIA knew that heroin causes no consciousness expansion. It brings on physical feeling, a warm glowing high, then dullness and insulation. But the government was interested in behavior control. Heroin, like LSD, was an important tool in gaining such control. While government, some clandestine agencies of government were busy distributing drugs to pleasure-seeking underground America, and the laboratories that were studying drugs for their capacities to provide access to the mind for purposes of behavioral control. Seeking the perfect incapacitating agent, Army chemists at Edgewood Arsenal came up with a drug known as BZ, whose effects were 10 times more powerful than LSD. Described as a hallucinogenic superdrug, BZ was used to be so powerful that a person who took it often experienced amnesia for long periods of time afterwards. To test its limits, BZ was given to 2,490 volunteers. General Lloyd Fellini's, a former commander of the Edgewood facility, said that the purpose of the BZ experiment was to produce an incapacitation gas sprayed from the sky, as in the film Jacob's Ladder, or delivered as a drug which could be placed in an empty water supply. Dr. Solomon Snyder, a professor of psychiatry and pharmacology at Johns Hopkins University Medical School, had formerly worked at Edgewood, said, "The Army's testing of LSD was just a sideshow compared to its use of BZ. Nobody can tell you for sure it won't cause a long-lasting effect. With an initial effect of 80 hours compared to 8 hours for LSD, he would have to worry more about its long-lasting or recurrent effects. Dr. George Afghanahan, who also reported at Edgewood, confirmed Snyder's opinion. With LSD, Afghanahan explained, you tend to dwell on the experience and recall it. That can lead to flashbacks. But with BZ, an amnesia occurs afterwards that blocks the experience out. Predicting the course of future events, Gottschalk's report stated, the volume of effort devoted to studying this behavioral effects of drugs has expanded tremendously in recent years and will probably continue to grow. In part, this may be attributed to the ready financial support such activities have achieved. The interest of scientists in employing drugs in research, however, transcends an interest in drug effects per se. Drugs constitute valuable tools for experimentation directed toward developing basic physiological and psychological knowledge. Work by scientists in several such areas in particular will increase knowledge of drugs which may be exploited by interrogators. Gottschalk's conclusions was that drugs can operate as positive catalysts to productive interrogation, combined with the many other stresses in captivity that an individual may be obligated to undergo. Drugs can add to the factors aimed at weakening the resistance of the potential informant. But for many reasons, the use of drugs by an interrogator is not sure to produce valid results. The effects of the drugs depend to a large extent on the person's personality makeup and physiological state of the informant and the kind of rapport that the interrogator is also able to establish with the informant. Knowing the predominating pharmacological actions of a number of psychoactive drugs, an interrogation team might choose that chemical agent which is most likely to be effective in view of the informant's personality, physical status, and various stressful experience he has already undergone. This study and subsequent ones verify the fact that a number of drugs could conveniently be used to take over the human mind against the will of the individual. Through the use of drugs, the skilled mind controller could first induce a hypnotic trance. Then, one of the several behavior modification techniques could be employed with amplified success. In themselves, without directed suggestions, drugs affect the mind in random ways. But when drugs are combined with classical conditioning and the language of hypnosis, an individual can be molded and manipulated beyond his own recognition. The government's interest in controlling minds and motivating involuntary behavior was focused not only on individuals but also on large groups. Mass hypnosis and crowd psychology were all known phenomena. To that end, propaganda techniques had already been developed, but mass narcosis was a new concept out of which grew the idea of non-kill warfare, where vast populations could simultaneously, or in one action, be drugged into submission. In 1961, an appearance before the Subcommittee on Science and Astronautics of the House of Representatives, Major General Marshall Stubbs, head of the Army Chemical Corps, gave a speech cautioning that we have not gone far enough in our research on the incapacitating compounds to be confident that we have real potential in warfare. We do not want to exaggerate claims for them to create the impression that we are on the verge of a bloodless war. General Stubbs admitted, we are attempting to completely separate the incapacitating agents from the lethal agents so that any castigation normally given to toxic agents will not be associated with them, since they do not maim or kill. As a result, we hope to have a weapon which will give the commander much freer rein in its use as a component to the toxic agents. It is my hope that through the use of incapacitating agents, the free world will have a relatively clear and rapid means of both fighting and deterring limited war, which has come to the forefront in the international political scene in the last several years. It is one means by which we can maintain some degree of equality in the face of overwhelming manpower superiority of the communist-dominated nations. One idea consistently expressed in the utterances of government employees was the idea that we must beat the commies to the punch. To that end, the Army launched a crash program investigating nerve gases, riot control gases, defoliants, herbicides, and biological agents such as anthrax,
Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and bubonic plague. It's also developed what is called harassing agents, chemicals that cause headaches, vomiting, and severe pain. The idea was that one saboteur would be able to carry enough in his pocket to temporarily incapacitate the population of a city the size of New York. A two-suiter piece of luggage could hold enough drugs to disable every man, woman, and child in America. Most of the drugs of the government experiment were odorless, colorless, and tasteless, and therefore undetectable. They were easily soluble in water, and only slowly would they lose their potency, chlorinated in water supplies. Food which came into contact with these chemicals remained contaminated for days, unless thoroughly washed. The inhalation particles of these drugs suspended in the air produced the same effects as ingestion. Dissolved, they could penetrate the skin and enter the bloodstream without having been ingested. The army assumed that a city exposed to such chemical attack would cease to function. The inhabitants, so confused by the trip that the army could march into the city and take over, facing only minimal resistance. And the next day, the populace would return to normal consciousness and be fit to work for the occupying army. To test their assumption, the army gave a squad of soldiers LSD and a coffee without their knowledge. After the drug effects began, the soldiers were ordered by their sergeant to perform normal and routine tasks while they were being filmed by a hidden camera. They could not follow even the most simplest command, nor accomplish the most ordinary tasks with an acceptable degree of competency. Two of the men simply giggled helplessly throughout the entire afternoon. As the platoon sergeant was not a coffee drinker, he did not receive the drug, neither had he been told about the test. Accordingly, he grew more and more frustrated and perplexed as his men acted more and more erratically. Further studies indicated, however, that in actual warframe things would not be that easy. Urban populations spend relatively little time out of doors. Since most of these drugs settled out of the atmosphere quickly and did not pass through air conditioning systems, they would therefore not affect everyone. They would affect only parts. If their water supply were lightly laced with a psychedelic, an individual would have to drink a pint of tap water before even being affected. The concentration could be made heavier, enough so that one would only have to brush his teeth or wash his face before getting high, but with concentrations that large, even an infant's formula or a cup of tea would be dangerous poison. Those exposed to minute amounts of those incapacitated agents might be able to fight off the symptoms. Those heavily dosed would suffer enormous mental distortions and could become wildly irrational. Mildly intoxicated persons might go about as if in a normal state, unaware that their judgment and motor skills were impaired. The resulting number of incidents that would be monumental. The army pretended to shelve its plans for non-kill warfare, but the major obstacle, as they saw it, was only the drugs. It was not that they might kill the enemy, but that, as of yet, the army was unable to immunize its own troops against drug effects. Not until 1975 was a reliable LSD antidote developed. Thank you.